Okay, so I'm calling the meeting to order and can we do a roll call?
Mr. Butler?
Dr. Savalas Candu?
Here.
Mr. Dively? Dr. Eagle?
Here.
Ms. Jacobson?
Here.
Ms. Jones?
Present.
Dr. King?
Here.
Ms. Lang?
Present.
Dr. Mobley Smith?
Here.
Mr. Simmons?
Here by phone.
Ms. Smart?
Here. Wow, it's like a record for us, isn't it?
That's right.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay, so we need to do consideration of participation by other mayor boards who are not here. Do I need to do a motion? Okay, can I hear a motion?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion passes. Okay, I'm gonna turn over to you to start by welcoming our new members.
Great, thank you very much. So yeah, so welcome. We have a couple of new members today. And for those of you that are new members, you will maybe be happy to know that you're not coming brand new in because most of the members that we have here are fairly new members as well. So some of them, a lot of them are veterans of two meetings. Many of them are brand new as well. So again, so thank you for coming. So if you don't mind, if we could just do a quick introduction. So, and I apologize, Pedro, I'll get your last name incorrect. So if you could just introduce yourself briefly in a kind of 30-second background, and then we'll also have Ms. Lang do that as well.
Okay, thank you. I'm representing Governor State University. I'm also very new in that for a veteran of one meeting. And sit over here. My background, I came to the States, to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And I got a doctorate in civil engineering. After that, I was in the faculty of IIT in Chicago for a few years. And after that, I became consulting. And I was an entrepreneur. I had a large engineering company, about 300 people that we sold 3 years ago. And now I'm doing other things, like being here today. Thank you very much for having me here.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Lang, thank you.
Hi, Keisha Lang from Western Illinois University. I've been on the board since March, so I'm happy to be a part of the Merit Board. I'm looking forward to learning a lot and being accessible to you all.
Thank you. Thank you very
much. Hello, Keisha.
Hey, Bob, we have a screen that is not y'all. You're in a very small screen at the bottom.
No, that's not.
Oh, there you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And it's John that's on the phone, right?
Yes, John
yes.
Sanders on the phone from representing SAU Edwardsville.
Okay, so I don't know.
Sorry,
we're hearing a lot of paper shuffling, so I don't know if it's the phone or if it's one of the rooms. So if we could either mute or just move it away from the mic, I'd really appreciate it. Okay. Okay, are we moving right into...
Right, so we have our next item, as we always do, put towards the top of our agenda, our public comments. We had initially not had any requests for public comments, but we recently have received one from the person who also is going to be considered in the pending discharge case. And so it is usually our practice when we have public comments that are specific to a very specific agenda item, that we move that public comment to that agenda item. You all just by, if you choose to, you all by just by a simple indicating that you would like to do that, we can move that public comment. Otherwise, the public comment can go now, and then we can have the case. So it's really up to the board.
Is anyone opposed if we move it to be with the case instead of now and then later do the case? Does anybody oppose that?
Okay,
all right, that's what we'll do.
So we will hold that public comment again until the case, and we'll move on to five, and I'll turn it back to the chair for the minutes. Thank you, Gail. Do we have anyone else that is requesting public comment at this moment?
That's not presented.
Right. Okay, thank you. Thank you.
So I just have a procedural question
for
public comments.
Sure.
So at the board, right, you can't just walk in and say there's notice and that you have to do it within a certain number of days. Do we not have that?
We don't, but it's something within our power somewhat in our power to change. Okay. One of the things that we have to do is the agenda has to already be published before you would ever have any kind of a time frame of when someone could request public comment. So there is some wiggle room that we have to do that.
Let's just put that up for a conversation at some point.
Okay, great.
Okay. All right. Then the next section is section 5. Obviously, not all of you were here for the meeting, but did anyone have any comments or changes to the minutes for those of you that were here? And if not, can I hear a motion to approve, please?
So move.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Okay. The minutes are therefore approved. Okay. I will also suggest that just we always approve the minutes and then go to the next thing first, because then they would have been together anyway. So gotcha. There you go.
Very good.
Okay. I will turn it over. Is my turning it over to Gail or to you?
Well, so we do have one discharge case today, and yes, we will turn it over to Gail, and she will start with a summary of the case, which also was in your packet as well. And Gail, if you'll go ahead and start with the summary, please.
University of Illinois at Chicago filed written charges for discharge against Shamita Underwood on June 6, 2019. Ms. Underwood, a building service worker at UIC Hospital since September 13, 2015, made a timely request for a discharge hearing. UIC filed 4 charges against Ms. Underwood: job abandonment, failure to adhere to the department's order to report to work, failure to adhere to the department's call-in procedures, and unexcused and unauthorized absences. Beginning in September 2017, UIC began progressive discipline regarding Ms. Underwood's tardiness. On September 13, 2017, UIC issued a letter of warning to Ms. Underwood for 16 incidents of tardiness between October 21, 2016 and July 22, 2017. On July 24, 2018, UIC issued a letter of warning to Ms. Underwood for an additional 15 incidents of tardiness between January 1, 2018 and July 7, 2018. On March 5, 2019, UIC issued a 5 calendar day unpaid disciplinary suspension for an additional 24 incidents of tardiness between August 1, 2018 and January 15, 2019. The hearing record shows the following: that Ms. Underwood received the Environmental Services Department handbook on July 9, 2018, and Ms. Underwood acknowledged that she was required to adhere to departmental policies. The Environmental Services Department requires employees to request time off in advance and in writing. No request should be considered approved until it was signed by the department director or superintendent. Any absence that is not approved will be recorded as an unexcused absence and will not be paid. Employees are expected to call in to a specific telephone number each day that they will be absent. If an employee is unable to call in before they will be absent, the absence might still be considered excused, but the employee can later show that they were not able to call in. Ms. Underwood stated that she was experiencing unspecified health problems. Ms. Underwood's physician had not been able to diagnose her health problems and could not complete her disability paperwork. Ms. Underwood stated that her supervisors knew of those health problems. Ms. Underwood stated that she had been approved for leave pursuant to Federal Family Medical Leave Act, the FMLA, but there is no information regarding the specifics of such leave in the record. The last day Ms. Underwood was physically at work was February 15, 2019. On February 20, 2019, UIC notified Ms. Underwood that she would be suspended for 5 work days for 24 incidences of tardiness that occurred between August 1, 2018 and January 15, 2019. That suspension occurred from March 10 through March 16, 2019. After that, Ms. Underwood was paid for 2 previously scheduled vacation days and a gift day taken March 17, 18, and 19. On May 8, 2019, UIC issued a letter ordering Ms. Underwood to return to work on May 13, 2019. On May 17, 2019, UIC notified Ms. Underwood that UIC intended to initiate discharge proceedings. As I stated when I began, those proceedings were filed on June 6, 2019. The hearing officer, Kim Kern, found that the employer met its burden of proof on all 4 charges against Ms. Underwood. The mayor court should be aware that there is, the procedural history of this case is unusual. The history is so unique that the collective memory of staff does not recall a similar situation or case. On June 6, 2019, written charges for discharge were filed and UIC served them on Ms. Underwood. On June 20, Ms. Underwood made a timely request for a hearing. The one-day hearing was held on July 19, 2019, within the 45-day period required by the Act. On July 25, Ms. Underwood's closing statement, along with attachments that were not presented by Ms. Underwood at the discharge hearing, was received by the system office. On July 26, UIC's post-hearing brief was received by the system office. On August 26, 2019, findings of fact were filed by the hearing officer, Elizabeth Simon. Ms. Simon stated that she based her findings in part on documents submitted by Ms. Underwood with her closing statement, that Ms. Underwood had not presented or admitted into evidence and were not part of the hearing record. Our rules require that findings of fact be exclusively on the evidence. UIC filed an objection to and motion to strike Ms. Underwood's written closing statement, arguing that because Ms. Underwood's written closing included documents that were not part of the hearing record and was not properly served on UIC, then Ms. Underwood's closing statement should be stricken from the record. On September 26, 2019, the executive director ruled on UIC's motion to strike, denying it in part and granting it in part. Specifically, the executive director denied UIC's request to strike Ms. Underwood's written closing statement. Granting UIC's request to strike the documents that had been attached to Ms. Underwood's written closing statement because counsel for UIC had no opportunity to review the documents, no opportunity to ask any witness about those documents, and no opportunity to object to the admissibility of any of those documents. As further relief, the executive director disqualified Elizabeth Simon as hearing officer in this matter on the basis of bias. The executive director appointed Kim L. Kern as hearing officer in this matter to prepare findings of fact that comply with the rules. The hearing record was decertified on September 3rd. Struck from the record were the findings of fact submitted by the hearing officer, Simon. And the executive director instructed which documents should be forwarded to hearing officer Kern, requesting that Ms. Kern submit findings of fact by October 25, 2019, and asking that the secretary to the merit board then recertify the record.
So there are a couple things, and Ms. Smart, if you don't mind me interrupting. So we have a request, as you all had indicated earlier, from a public comment from Ms. Underwood, who is here today. So that would be appropriate to do that now. We also have a motion from University Council, University of Illinois Chicago, to also present information as well, which can be done also at this time, again, assuming the board would like to accept that. So it would be a recommendation of staff to the board that we allow each party to speak. There is a 5-minute, I think our bylaws call for a 5-minute time frame to do that on those, but it would be, again, recommendation from staff that we let both parties speak at this time to the board regarding this case, but obviously it's a
board decision. Does anyone object to that? Either party? And is there a procedure for which party goes first?
We would probably have Ms. Underwood go first, as she had submitted an Open Meetings Act, and then the university had submitted a motion to speak to this particular case, so we would allow them to go second.
Could we repeat what's happening? I'm sorry.
So for our disciplinary case, Ms. Atwood is here and would like to speak, and then representation from UIC will also like to speak, and there were no objections to that. Oh, Underwood, sorry. Sorry, my bad.
So Ms. Underwood, I believe you are here. If you'd like to come up maybe here near Gail, I think is probably the easiest place to stand, and you can make a presentation.
Can I make one comment before?
Of course.
In the past, and I was on the board for about 5 or 10 years, about 10 years ago, and in the past, we never did this. I understand they're both here and ready to speak and may as well hear this, but this is kind of an unusual situation, just so everybody's aware. I don't want to turn into a trier of fact, is what I'm saying.
Right, and so, Mr. Simmons, you're correct. When you were on the board, we rarely, if ever, had anyone ever present before the board, and that has changed somewhat during that time. However, excuse me, one of the discussion points, I know the current chair and others on the board have wanted to have for discussion, and again, our next agenda item is going to be about the discharge rule, is what kinds of things do we want to include as we revise that discharge rule, specifically to your point today, of having presentations and what kind of presentation should or should not be allowed in front of the board.
We can take this offline, but we have to allow for public comment. So we can't stop any individual from coming to make a comment about anything that they want to. So, and we have had other cases where the attorney has spoken.
Yes. Yes, we have.
The only thing that I do have to tell both of our speakers is that if we have to make a decision based on what is on the record. So if you tell us anything today that is not already included, we cannot consider that, whether we want to or not. And that's for both parties. So if it wasn't already presented as part of the hearing, we cannot take that into consideration.
Thank you.
That's correct,
yes,
right? That's,
yes.
By law,
yes, the chair
we
is
cannot.
Correct. The chair is correct.
Right. We don't. It's not us not wanting to. If we can. Okay.
Ms. Underwood.
Can you guys see her?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
You need to get a microphone.
Here, let's see. You want to? Would you like a chair? Here. So they can see you. Well, I'll let our attorney.
If I may, you received.
Let's repeat the question because they probably couldn't hear it.
The question Ms. Underwood asked is, how does she know what's been admitted in the record? And you received a copy of the certified record from the secretary for the mayor and court.
Right, that's what I'm saying. The documents from the doctor wasn't accepted, but the other paperwork. I wasn't sure.
Your written closing is part of the record. The documents that were stricken are not.
Okay. I would just like to say that I'm hoping that I do get to keep my job today. I want to say thank you for the time that you've given me. I've made some mistakes. I've learned from those mistakes. Now I understand. I should have went back to my booking and followed through to see exactly what the exact procedures were. I'm just hoping that things go for the better in a couple years. If so, I'm going to listen and know what and what not to do at this point now. I had other stuff, but since it's not in the book, I can't speak on it. So I'll just leave it at that.
Well, we can't tell you what to say or not say. I can only tell you what we can take into consideration. I don't want you to think that you can't say something.
I did want to say I was coming to work sick, and the picture and I had staff that would tell me, you need to take care of yourself because I was coming into work. And I was having issues, and they were sending me to the emergency room with some of those issues. So it wasn't, I guess I'm not really explaining. I did go to the doctor and try to get things situated, and I guess I just didn't handle it appropriately. I'm just not 100% sure what I was saying. Just kind of lost my thing. Kind of stuck in a moment. But hopefully things, I'm just hoping for the best. I would like to keep my job and keep working. It's been kind of hard outside of that, but I have to keep moving. And I have been working with my health issues, and they're getting better and better. So that's a plus. But I'm just hoping to keep my job at this point.
Thank you, Ms. Underwood.
Thank you.
Thank you. Washington legal counsel is here from West Chicago.
Hi, everyone. Those of you that don't know me, my name is Matt Jones. I'm with the Office of University Counsel for the University of Illinois. So this employee, I won't go through the disciplinary history because Gail kind of already did that. I think, you know, the crux of this case was the problem where Ms. Underwood just wouldn't let her employer know whether she's coming to work or not. So it kind of left her department in a rough situation where, you know, they might plan to have somebody work and then that person doesn't show up. And, you know, this stuff certainly happens, but I think it became such an issue at a certain point that the department felt it was necessary to contact human resources and then, you know, eventually legal counsel to see what they could do about this. I'll go through we submit post-hearing briefs for these things. So I'll go through a little portion of my post-hearing brief because this hearing happened back in July, so I don't necessarily remember every detail here. But essentially, the department maintains employee absence record, making essentially a record of if somebody's going to be absent and the reason why they're going to be absent. So the absence record for this employee indicates that the last day she had reported to work at the university when she was finally discharged in, I think it was June of 2018, June of 2018 when they finally went forward with this. So the last day she had reported to work was February 15th. It was June of 2019 was when they moved forward with discharge, and then the last day she had reported to work was February 15th. The employee absence record also indicates that she was either recorded as no call or no call, late call on about 9 occasions in February of 2019, at least 12 occasions in March of 2019, and in April of 2019 it was 22 occasions. In May of 2019, she was recorded as no call on at least 10 occasions before the university informed her of its intent to actually initiate discharge proceedings against her. There's no dispute here that the employee didn't report her absences in accordance with departmental policy, or that she received the departmental policy. One of the exhibits is the departmental policy that has her signature, and I think it's fairly recent. It's from 2018. The employer did try and get her back to work. They sent her an order to report for work to her home address. That didn't end up getting her back to work. She did eventually attend a reconciliation meeting prior to the final decision to move forward with discharge. But again, there was just no real explanation for this, why she couldn't just let her employer know whether she was going to be at work or not. Certainly, the employer understands, you know, people get sick, they offer benefit time, just need to make sure that the employer has a heads up that somebody's not going to be in so they can staff the department accordingly. There was a reference to doctor's notes. I think at the time, the university didn't have anything or had something that maybe indicated that just a general, please excuse the employee from work for a certain period, but she's fine to return now. But so the fine that she was to return now indicates to the employer that there was certainly a long period of time that wasn't excused. There was an indication that she had been certified for intermittent FMLA 2 days, 2 days per month, maybe. Even an intermittent FMLA certification is going to say you have to let your employer know when you're going to use those days. You can't just not show up for work, not let your employer know if you're coming to work. So I think that was the gist of this problem, where given all the problems in the past and that they tried to get her to report to work by sending an order to report to work, and that she just didn't call in, and she knew she was supposed to do it. And there's no circumstances like she, you know, obviously if somebody is unable to call in, we would understand that, but the record doesn't reflect that there's any situation like that, like she was unable to just call in and let the employer know, you know, whether she's going to be at work or not. So that's really the gist of the case from the employer's perspective.
Thank you. Okay, so to have the consideration of the discharge proceedings, I believe we can go into a closed session.
I would actually, in this particular case, I actually would support the chair's idea. The procedural elements of this are more odd than, as Gail indicated, than we have ever had in the history of this board. And I would think it may be a wise choice for now to at least have a brief executive session regarding that particular thing.
And procedurally, and we are allowed to do that.
Procedurally, we're allowed to do that. And I would, again, I would support the chair, but obviously it's the vote of the board to do that. Yeah. And you would need a motion.
Do I hear a motion to
move executive session? Into executive session.
Do I hear a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, we will go into an executive session. So we have returned to open session, and we had lengthy conversation, and we have decided that we will be deferring our decision. And do I hear a motion for that?
I move.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
All in favor of deferring our decision?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, that is what we will do. And we need to go to the next topic, correct? Okay. Okay, report of the Human Resources Advisory Committee. Who is our speaker today?
Me.
Okay.
On behalf of somebody else.
Get out of the way here for me.
Good afternoon, members of the Merit Board, System Office staff, HR colleagues, and Employee Advisory Committee members. My name is Michael Ginsberg. I'm Associate Vice Chancellor for Human Resources here at UIC, but I'm providing the report today on behalf of Amelia Hartnett, who's the Director of Human Resources at Western Illinois University, who is unable to be here today. I'm pleased to address you today on behalf of our colleagues who comprise the Human Resources Directors Advisory Committee. HR DAC works directly with the System Office on matters relevant to our campuses and our employees. We'd like to first start by welcoming our new Merit Board members, and we look forward to working with you further on all the human resources matters that strengthen the institutions you represent, as well as all of those in public higher education in Illinois. Since your last meeting, we have continued to collaboratively work on ongoing projects with the System Office and with each other. We met with the System Office on November 8th and had a productive discussion on a variety of topics that I will review today. We appreciate the new audit schedule, which has been revised and publicized so that our offices and campuses can plan and prepare for our next audit from the System Office. And with that in mind, a continued point of focus for all of us is complying with the revised civil service exemption procedures, especially as it relates to principal administrative appointments. Each institution is tackling complying in their own way. This has required a great deal of thought, planning, and action. And we've relied on learning from each other and continued open dialogue with the System Office to determine how to best move forward. We're interested to learn the outcome of the first few campuses to be audited after the changes to the procedure. Members of HRDEF requested the System Office staff provide training on interpreting the revised exemption procedures to members of our staffs. We appreciate that the System Office responded by offering a variety of training opportunities to our HR professionals, including one on civil service exemptions. We also appreciate the opportunity to work with the System Office, especially Jeff and Gail, on revising the discipline process. We are excited about the improvements that we have collectively made to the process and look forward to a meeting with the Merit Board members to continue this productive discussion. We remain interested in what Merit Board members want from us and our legal counsels when reviewing discharge cases. And we ask that the Merit Board approve item number 9 on your agenda today, which is the proposed rulemaking regarding the discharge and demotion rules. Finally, the issue of resolving the employment issues unique to grant-funded positions is still of high importance to our campuses, especially here at UIC, where we've highlighted this program. We appreciate the work the system office has put into this topic, and we hope to continue to be involved in finding a suitable solution. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today and for your services, members of the Merit Board.
Thank you. Any questions?
I would like to, Michael, and for the rest of the board, just quickly, because I know part of your presentation was discussion, obviously, of the new revised procedures. We did do a just kind of a quick statistical check in the, just looking at quarterly reports. So approximately a year ago, under the category that was of concern, which is the academic professionals or technically the PAAs, E3s, there were approximately 6,100 of those employees. This year, again, approximately the same date, there was about 900 less, or 5,000, a little over, around 5,200. Conversely, on the civil service employment side, again, approximately a year ago, there were a little over 18,000 of those employees, and there currently are a little bit over 19,000. There is no conclusion one can make just from simple numbers, except to say that the numbers are what we had hoped and what the concerns were, would appear to be, for one very short period of time, going in that direction. So we appreciate, again, I know you had mentioned the work, obviously, that not only you've done here, and I know you were actually speaking for Western, or for Amelia, not necessarily for Western, but for the group, and so we do appreciate that. So I just wanted to bring that note up, since you've been mentioning it too. So thank you, or thank you to your HR group. Thanks.
Thank you. Next, report of the State University's Employee Advisory Committee.
Good afternoon. I'm Jill Odom, speaking on behalf of the Employee Advisory Committee. Distinguished members of the State University Civil Service Merit Board, on behalf of the Employee Advisory Committee, I would like to say thank you to you for your continued support. We truly value your time and fully understand the commitment involved in being part of this board. To our new members, Mr. Carvalho's Kendall from, I hope I pronounced that correctly, from Governor okay. State, and Ms. Lang from Western Illinois University, we would like to say welcome, and we are honored to have you join our board. Your Employee Advisory Committee, are looking forward to getting to know you and working with you as well. Our last quarterly meeting was on Wednesday, October 16th, and Thursday, October 17th at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Then on Friday, October 18th, UIC also hosted Council of Councils, which is an annual gathering of all the employee councils and or senates from each of the state universities. This was the 22nd annual Council of Councils, and just as in councils past, we had the opportunity to exchange ideas, share valuable information relevant to our civil service employees, and discuss programs and initiatives our constituents are excited and concerned about. On Wednesday at our quarterly meeting, we began with the installation of our newest member, Mr. Clay Stalter, who was newly elected from the University of Illinois Springfield. So we are also an ever-changing board. Afterwards, we welcome Director Brownfield, Gail, and Danielle from the Citizens Office. We had a good deal of discussion with Jeff regarding the topic of grant-funded employees. This is a topic that has been discussed at great length, even during our discussions over the revisions to the current exemption procedures. So it's been ongoing. EAC, as a group, agrees that grant-funded employees' employment rights need to be consistent, defined, and equal to current civil service employees, but understand that there are a number of variables that still need to be vetted. We will continue to encourage collaborative discussion and address our concerns with you and Director Brownfield. We also had lengthy discussion with Jeff and Gail regarding proposed changes and updates to the discharge process. At our recent executive committee meeting, our committee proposed updates were further discussed, and a motion was made to support the proposed changes as presented in the November 5th, 2019 draft in the spirit of efficiencies with the agreement that no diminishment of employee protections were presented. In our discussions with Director Brownfield in our October meeting, he indicated that the intent is not to diminish or enhance rights, only to make the process easier to read, follow, and use. And we look forward to that. As 250.110 moves through the JCAR process, EAC will be available for discussion and comment, and we look forward to that as well. On Thursday, which is day two of our meeting, we were joined by Dr. Ginsburg, who is the DER for UIC. Among other things, he shared that UIC leadership works closely with its response with its and is responsive to the UIC Staff Advisory Council. This collaborative working relationship helps bridge the gap between employment groups, and he believes has further helped in the PAA conversion process. UIC had a head start in the conversion process, though as several years ago, they identified approximately 700 positions which were incorrectly exempted and were converted to civil service. This was not an easy task and took a great amount of effort and time, but Dr. Ginsburg states that UIC now has a much better understanding of what does and does not qualify positions to be exempted. Dr. Ginsburg also noted that UIC spent a great deal of time helping employees as well as leadership understand the scope of civil service classifications and try to emphasize that no class of employee is less than another. We had a great discussion with Dr. Ginsburg and hope that this is an example that other universities can show forward. Most of the EAC membership reports that their respective universities are embracing the conversion of PAA to civil service with some diligence as it relates to new or recently vacated positions. However, the conversion of current positions is not progressing as we had hoped. We are all eager to see the data once the audits have resumed and there are measurable statistics. Our first quarterly meeting of 2020 is scheduled for Wednesday, January 29th, and on Thursday, January 30th, here at the Systems Office on Philo Road. If you're interested in joining us here, please contact Director Brownfield or myself. We'd love to have you join us. Thank you again for your time, your support, and again, we look forward to working with you to make 2020 our most productive year yet. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay. All right. We're going to now talk about the proposed some changes. So Jeff, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. And actually, I'll turn it over to Gail, but I did want to just mention one thing. So the next agenda item is the discussion of the discharge rule. And we have had, obviously, lots of discussions about this. We've met formally on two or three different occasions with the HR directors. We've met formally as was discussed by Jill with the EAC group. We've had multiple informal discussions. We've also met with union representatives from AFSCME and SEIU as well to get us to this point. And the one thing I want to emphasize, and again, Gail's going to kind of hit a couple high points on a couple of the pages that follow the agenda item in your book. The thing I want to emphasize, though, to everybody is this is not the end of the process. This is actually the start of the process. So what we're doing is if you approve this to go forward today, if that's your vote to move this forward, we will submit this to JCAR. My guess will be probably in mid-January or thereabouts after we get back from break. And there's a variety of forms that we have to do in order to do so. We will get that submitted. And then we will have variety or a series, if you will, of more formal conversations with, again, the HR directors group, the employee advisory group, obviously with you all. During this first notice period, there also is a second notice period which we can discuss at a time that comes about. I cannot believe that with the complexity of this, that we can get this done in any less than about 6 months, 5 to 6 months or so to do this. If it goes faster, hey, great, but I really don't believe that will be the case. So again, I just want to emphasize, and again, Gail's going to pick out a couple of kind of bullet points, if you will, to discuss with all of you. Again, just to emphasize, this is the beginning of the process, not the end of the process.
Before I get to the bullet points, I just want to offer you a color key for my document. Mm-hmm. Everything that's in gray, that's been grayed out, is because I moved it somewhere else within that rule. The red is mostly that, that it's been moved somewhere else within the rule. And I did that because it would make it makes logical sense to me in that order. It's where council would expect to see it. We've added paragraph headings so that people could actually search for what they'd be looking for. So down to the bullet point. So on page one behind tab nine.
I'm sorry, Gail. I failed to mention this. I'm sorry. So for those of you that are there from EAC here in the room and also from the HR directors, the document that we're discussing today is 98%, 99% exactly what we have discussed with you recently, outside of some typos and another few changes. There is no substantive change that Gail will be discussing with the board that you have not seen in one of those last meetings, again, outside of just a very few minor typos. I'm sorry, Gail.
No, it's quite all right. From the 11.5 draft, I removed one duplicated phrase, and that's all. So it's an ivory. So again, on page one behind tab nine, we have modified a couple of causes justifying suspension. So we had meetings with HR DAC, with EAC, with a couple of union folks, because we're going to need their buy-in. Based on feedback we received from those, we added some information to causes justifying suspension. So those are falsification documents. We took out some time card information. We removed intoxication based on intoxication from alcohol, and talked about impairment regardless of the cause of the impairment. And we added inability to perform duties in a competent and satisfactory manner. That's the highlight on page one. Page 10, if you would.
Wait, that looks like it struck out. Isn't it just the opposite?
I'm sorry. Oh. Down below, in section F1.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was below. Okay, sorry.
So it's because we struck it out. Yes. Drinking, consuming, we didn't care how you consumed your intoxicating object.
Okay.
And certainly the law is about to change in Illinois. Watch this space for more developments. On page 10, we added some information regarding ex parte communication with the board, specifically regarding discharge matters. There had been some concern that either university counsel, some representative from the university, or possibly some employee, just on their own behalf, could write to the board. It's your information is public. People could theoretically seek you out, send you information. That would be absolutely improper in a discharge matter, and wanted to make sure that in the rule, it's clear that ex parte communication with the board is improper. Page 17 is in the lovely blue, because we both removed it twice, we've changed it a couple of times. We've deleted, in the middle of the page, you will see that written closing arguments has been deleted. One of the problems that we had in the matter that was before the board today came about as a result of a written closing argument. If there had been simply oral closing arguments at the close of evidence, it never would have happened. It is quite unusual in most circumstances for written closings to happen, and we would just be, I believe, simplifying and clarifying the process for the board. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to chat about them. Otherwise, that is my report for this document. So.
I had one question. Actually, it was at the bottom of page 17 under request for motion for permission to make oral argument. Is that standard? I guess I asked myself that question.
Which piece? The green.
Yeah.
I've added to clarify and emphasize that the reason the board would entertain oral argument would be to understand some extraordinary matter. Otherwise, everything should be taken up by the hearing officer. If something truly extraordinary were to happen between the hearing and the merit board meeting, that I believe could be reasonably addressed by the merit board. Otherwise, I would encourage the merit board to limit oral argument to extraordinary matter.
And this, Dr. Eagle, there was a time prior when there was virtually no presentation before the board. And through time, that standard has somewhat changed. And again, as you know, on your time on the board, being here for more than one or two meetings, we have these presentations, right? We have these presentations routinely, and in the past, it had, and I would say virtually never happened before, because there was not this extraordinary piece of information, this lightning bolt, if you will, out of the blue that has come about. And so therefore, we're trying to draw back. This has been in the rule too. This has always been part of the rule. we have allowed, again, the slippery slope that is discussed many times. The slippery slope has gotten much more slippery and much steeper, and we have had lots of presentations of information that probably was not the best.
Well, so I have a question about this now, because after I've learned a lot in the last week about some of this stuff, as you know, we spent a lot of time before the meeting even approved. Why does this then not say that if they're going to make an oral argument in front of us, that they have to stick to everything that's on the record, or can they present? This does not allow, this does not stop them from presenting something new to us in their oral argument.
The law, as stated, Illinois law prohibits.
But then that should say that in here, because this just says they can make an oral argument in front of us.
Well, we have to accept their petition.
Right, but even if we do, if the law is that they can't present anything new to us, or that we cannot consider anything new, then it should be specific in here that if we do approve a motion for an oral argument, and they present material that was not on the record, that the merit board cannot consider that. Assuming that's the law, that should absolutely be stated in here, I think.
Or I guess the other question is, according to this, they can come before us as an oral argument, but as we've just witnessed, you can also come in under a different route.
Correct. And there's no way to stop that.
Right.
There is no way to stop public comment.
Okay.
So obviously this is defined as a different kind
right.
of a public comment. It's not public at all. It's oral argument in this rule is limited to parties of record.
Executive session?
No, I'm sorry. It's so clear in my head, I apologize. It is limited to either the university or to the employee being discharged. Those are the only people who can request oral argument before the board.
What about the employee's attorney if they have one?
That would be the employee.
Okay, same thing.
They only
get
one bite at that apple.
Got it. Okay, got it.
Now, it's as Jeff suggested, this is about it's a motion for the board to permit that oral argument. If the board chooses not to, then the otherwise moving party would have to rely on their ability to speak it at open session.
Okay. All right. I still think it should be clear that if we approve it, it has to. Okay.
I have a note. Thank you very much.
Does it help, though, that it says the motion must specifically state the extraordinary issues to be presented, any relevant law, and then a synopsis of the argument being presented? Does that help to address that relative law? Relevant.
No, I see it.
Okay.
I personally still think it should be very clear that we cannot use it if they present something new.
You can certainly add that.
Okay.
I'm struggling with... What's the blue? What's the green again?
Oh,
it's all this new.
None of it is new, except I moved the very first sentence. Oral argument is reserved for presentation. That's new language in that place. Otherwise, none of this is new. It's just been moved around within the rules.
If it's new, it's underlined. If it's colored, it's moved. Is that the bottom line?
That's pretty much it.
Okay.
But we've modified
it's
this.
It's gray and crossed out.
It's gray.
We've moved
it from some place to another place within the rule, probably.
You mean if it's gray and crossed out?
It's gray,
out.
Yes.
It's just like words.
It is exactly.
Revision words. I mean, it is words.
That's exactly.
So it seems as though, can you help me understand? Seems as though that this moves chronologically. So K would be sort of, the person's through the hearing, now this is their option to speak to the board under these circumstances. And then what's being removed, was this supposed to control the manner in which people presided or the manner in which people presented to the board?
No.
Or was this references
the information
to the hearing?
That's grayed out. Was it's sort of a mix of and the reason the rule is being modified the way it is because that information is confusingly placed.
Right.
Because what I attempted to do is exactly what you suggest, make the thing read chronologically the way you would begin at the beginning with charges for suspension or discharge, and then walk through the process. What you see grayed out is just moved to what I thought was an appropriate spot.
But once we get to page 20, failure to appear, now we're back at the hearing, right?
So, right, so what happens on that? That, again, it's outside of the regular course of the hearing. So what the reason we have that in there is we have had instances where someone has requested a hearing and not shown. And then when they don't show up, previous to what we had done, the university was still required to put on, in essence, their entire case, which seemed...
In front of the merit board.
In front of the hearing officer, and then back to the okay. And then back to the merit board, obviously, to make the decision. So what we were trying to indicate here is, in essence, if you're going to request a hearing, if you're not going to bother to show up for that, the burden shouldn't be then placed still on the university to, in essence, make their case. So they have already, from their vantage point, from the university vantage point, they have already discharged the employee. You obviously had the final say of whether that's going to happen, but from their viewpoint, the person has been discharged. If you're not going to come, then there needs to, again, as it says in here, be an extraordinary reason why you were in an automobile accident or, you know, some other true tragedy has happened in order to do so.
If I may, if you take a look at the top of page 16, where it's new number 9, order of hearing. So everything that's on 16 and 17, my sense is that that's part of the hearing. The final part of the hearing would be an oral argument before the board, the merit board. The next piece is number 10, which is on page 20, which is if you fail to appear at the hearing, that's what happens next.
Right. So it's chronological in the sense that we now deal with the failure.
Exactly.
After
so
the
we were
failure.
Supposed to have had a hearing. Somebody's not there. What do we do now?
Right. Okay.
Okay.
And so frankly, it goes for the university too. No, I can't foresee a reason that would happen, but technically if the university didn't appear, outside again of somebody, you know, getting God forbid getting in an accident,
exactly
literally on
so.
The way to the hearing where, you know, something would happen.
So I have just a couple more questions about this.
Sure.
So when we get to page 24, now we're in the thick of it, right? The merit board is operating.
That is
nice. And the under B, reinstatement, there's 12, green.
12B.
Yeah. 12B.
I.
There's this green portion.
That is new language.
That is
new proposed language.
On what evidentiary record could we surmise that the proven charges do not justify disciplinary action?
That is the information that is within the sole discretion of the merit board, whether the information is as presented within the hearing and concluded in the findings of fact by the hearing officer, whether that information justifies disciplinary action. That is the merit board's job.
So this is really saying that if we choose to reinstate, there's two options. You reinstate where they didn't lose any money, or you reinstate and instead give them a suspension.
Three to 120 days, that's correct.
Right.
Well, there's this big B says we have to determine just cause for the discharges found not to exist. Before we get to little one, we have to conclude it does not exist.
Because if just cause for discharge exists, then the rule requires that the employee be discharged.
Okay, so we can't get to this assessment of whether we think the charges justify the disciplinary action unless we first conclude that just cause is found not to exist.
Just cause
for discharge.
That's correct. The first question before the board is whether just cause for discharge has been proven by the university.
So these aren't options. These are chronological decisions.
I would, from my perspective as counsel, my argument would be yes, that is correct. I would attend to these things chronologically.
So we first ask, is the university's decision to discharge based proven? And if we say yes, then we move to discharge.
Can you discharge?
If we have any doubt about whether that's proven, then we have as a potential remedy, not remedy, but as a potential action, either reinstatement with no compensation or with suspension.
And we've done that.
Reinstatement is no loss of compensation.
No loss of compensation, sorry.
Yes.
We did that. We changed one to a suspension. Okay, anything else on this? Okay, all right. Oh, do we have to take a motion for you guys to move forward with this, or do you just need our... We do? Okay, do I hear a motion to move forward in the process to making these changes?
So moved.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, you have permission to move forward. Okay, number 10.
So for number 10, we have used the top of your sheet there. There are a few bullet points of some of the areas we've tried to recruit for hearing officers. This is not always the most successful thing. Many of these folks, for the small amount that we pay, we oftentimes have difficulty getting people to be hearing officers. So the bottom part of that bullet points down there is to allow us to look for other attorneys in particular that have a practice within this realm of law to become hearing officers. And so is all we're asking to do is to be able to consider the folks that meet these bottom criteria, lawyer licensed to practice in Illinois, at least 5 years of experience in the practice of labor, employment law, and then substantial training equivalent needed for certification as an arbitrator or mediator. So we're just looking at trying to expand our pool of hearing officers for that is all we're trying to do here, and to get your permission to use this criteria, including the criteria that is above. It's not that we're getting rid of the top. This would just be an addition to.
And it's really just to make sure we have a bigger pool of people.
Correct.
So we can get them done faster.
That's correct. That is correct.
Okay. Do I hear a motion to approve? Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Thank you. Number 11.
So for number 11, we have what we call the, what we have is the Student Employment Pathway Program. You as a board or your predecessors approved this program a few years ago. What this allows for us to do and allows for our campuses to do is to do one of two things, either to make offers of employment to a current student who is about to graduate or is near graduation. Just as they get offers of employment for XYZ company in Chicago or Peoria or wherever they may be recruited to do, allows a little bit more of a standard or a level playing field, if you will, to do that. The other thing that it allows also is for students at your institution, any institution, but at your institution in particular, who may be a student worker, to transition right from that student worker position into a standard civil service job. We have had, I believe it is 4 universities that have participated in this program. It has been, unfortunately, from a number standpoint, unsuccessful. It was put in place when we had the largest part of our budget hit and budget impasse. There was minimal hiring that was going on, much less for this. So is all we're asking today is extend this program for a couple more years to see if we can reinvigorate it, for lack of a better term. Hopefully with a little bit more hiring that's going on now, we hope that we'll be able to place some more students. So is what we're requesting today is just to extend this program for 2 years, and we will be going back to those 4 or 5 campuses to see what their experiences have been, more specific, if we can get back to those employees to try and do that as well. So that's it's just an extension of the program for a couple of years.
I had a question. Were there any projects that we're doing?
We have had we've had less than 10 students placed at four different universities. Yeah. So it has been, like I say, as far as the reports back, it's been successful. I mean, there hasn't been complaints from that kind of standpoint. But again, the sample size is so amazingly small. There just is unfortunately not much that we can provide to you to say, you know, gosh, this is really working, or you know, we really need to tweak it this way or change it.
So what will be done differently?
There's 2 things that will be done. Well, actually, I should say there's 1 thing that will be done differently. Hopefully our employers are hiring people again where they had not been throughout the majority of this. And again, when I say they're not hiring anybody, obviously that's not true. They're not. It's not that there's been a complete 100% freeze. There just has been limited hiring during the course of this particular project. As we go forward, and as we have seen, even in simple things such as how much testing has been going on, there's been a uptick in employment and employment placement over this last year and a half or so since we've had a budget. And hopefully, all of you and us as well are getting an increase for our budget again in this budget cycle over the next few months.
Okay.
So that's what we're hoping to see.
And it doesn't cost any money.
It doesn't.
That was my first question.
Right. It doesn't. That's a great point. It does not cost anybody.
And it saves the recruiting cost of 10 people.
Hopefully.
Okay. So do we need to add a motion to extend the program?
I move to extend it.
Your second?
Second.
All in favor to extend the program?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, governance, risk, and compliance.
Cindy? Yes, ma'am.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Lucinda Neitzel, and I'm the Assistant Director of Legal and Compliance Services here at the System Office. As referenced in your previous meeting minutes, I'd resigned in my position in May of 2019 to pursue a career opportunity at Governor State University. I've since returned to the System Office effective November 1st. You should have received a copy of the new and revised audit schedule. And extending until the end of the current fiscal year. So our next visit will be at Chicago State University in January, Eastern in February, and then we will be at the Urbana campus in March. So barring any questions, that's all I really have to present. Looks clear. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. We are thrilled to have Cindy back. As much as Ann, Governor State, who's sitting here up here, stole her from us, we stole her back. And so she.
No robbery, right?
Right, right, exactly. So, anyway, so we are excited to have Cindy back, and she does have a lot of experience as the audit manager and, as she said, assistant director in compliance. And so we are excited to do that. And again, we will be back to the audit trail here in about 6 weeks or thereabouts.
Okay. Report of the executive director.
So just a couple of things to report to you. First of all, there's a just kind of a really brief breakdown of some budget things in your book. The one thing I did want to mention is that I did attend IBHE last week. We were recommended for a 5.5% increase to our budget, which is around 65,000 thereabouts. I think most of the campuses, though, you probably have already heard this through your own board, many of them were the suggestion again is I think around 5.9 or so for most of your campuses as far as for an increase in that. But nonetheless, we did 5.5. We've made presentations to the board before. You all had approved actually us requesting approximately $160,000 increase. Like I say, the recommendation was for around 64,000, and so we are cautiously optimistic, as I'm sure all of you are with your own institutions, that there will be some additional budget that we can do. We can hopefully again continue to ramp back up our standard employment. We did have one failed search back about a month and a half ago. We'll be redoing that starting in January to try and find an employee, and then hopefully if the rest of this goes through, we may be able to find an additional employee come summertime as well. Again, we are authorized for 21 employees. We have 13. So we are trying to slowly ramp back up to higher numbers of our office so we can serve, obviously, our constituents, all the universities, much more efficiently than sometimes what we can do right now. If there's no questions on that, our classification exam update. A couple of things with that, as I mentioned before, we've had some increases in our service employment. Some of the classifications that are listed in there, we are in the process of eliminating those or at least freezing them. This was part of, again, of the revised procedures that were put into place. We're in the process of doing that, but also we are having to do that with consideration of the rights that those employees currently have. There is no way we can just summarily remove the rights of those particular employees. So we will be continuing to move along with that, though at a fairly slow pace. A couple of things that have happened, and is, you know, one of the unfortunate side effects of 20 years of concerns with the way positions were exempted, is some of the classifications that are now available are very old because those positions were hired as academic professional positions, and therefore, when there weren't incumbents in them, we didn't concentrate on revising the classification. So we are trying to do more of that. Again, it's a slow process, but as again, our campuses find, well, this person was designated as AP before, but really should be civil service under the revised procedures. We again are trying to revise those classifications as quickly as we can. A couple of things that we're working on within that area too is, again, for many of those classifications, if not for all of them, but certainly for many of them, is assuring that bachelor's degrees are most often required for those positions. We do, though, as is our policy and will remain our policy, is that when we revise a classification, we want to look at the type of degree that is appropriate for the particular classification. So a bachelor's degree, to have a bachelor's degree, is not something that we will routinely put into any of our classifications. You all have, each of your campuses have 100 different majors, if you will, and there are differences between people who do accounting and people who do elementary education and people that are engineers. And so depending on the particular classification, we will continue to work and have those bachelor's degree fit, if you will, to the particular class to do so as well. So that is continuing on. Again, Danielle and her group do a good job with that, but it is, again, with just a couple of folks in that particular unit, they go slower than we would like, but we are moving along with them. The last thing here is the grant-funded employees that you've heard mentioned.
I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
What was the LAGHOP? What does that mean? Sorry.
What's the information in the column?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Those are for our use. Those are who are assigned to those, our staff members who are assigned. I'm sorry, we should have had a heading there. It's just our staff members that are assigned to that.
Okay.
Well, their initials. Sorry about that.
No wonder I couldn't.
You know what an effective date of LA is?
Right. I apologize for that. Yeah, that's our staff that are assigned to
those. Thanks.
We'll get you introduced when you're out.
The grant-funded employees is kind of, I think, the last part of this overall presentation. As you heard, Dr. Ginsburg and the HR Directors Group continue to work on that. The Employee Advisory Group continue to work on that. Our union representatives that we meet with continue to work on that. I don't know what else to say except we continue to work on it. We sometimes hit some issues that don't seem to be resolved at this point in time, and we'll try and keep working through them. It's an important project for all of us. We do have some significant resistance, as I've reported before, from some of our union representatives and the concern about having employees treated differently. And by differently, I mean through seniority and other civil service rights versus others. And at the same time, as again, for those of you that have been on the board for a little while and certainly our HR directors, the funding for your campuses continues to come in different forms than it has come in the past. And those different forms are oftentimes through grants, be it state grants, federal grants, private donations, private foundation money, those kinds of things that sometimes, many times, have a finite time frame on that money, unlike the general revenue, which we hope we can count on year after year after year, though obviously the last few years going through what's happened with the governor and the General Assembly has not quite been the case.
It probably makes sense for our new board members for you to spend a little bit of time, because this was an issue that we spent a lot of time on, even before some of our people who've been here for one or two meetings,
right,
in terms of which positions are civil service, which positions are PAs, and there was a lot of compromise on both sides, because whether you're in one category or another has very different consequences for you as an employee. And the issue with this, of course, and I can say this is really true in Urbana-Champaign for all of U of I, is we have so many research grants that we have people who are paid for by the research grants, and if we were to make them civil servant employees when the grant is over, that we might not have any job or any money for them. And so we're trying to find a compromise to where they're not totally disadvantaged, but yet it makes it work for everybody. So that's kind of the gist of.
And that's a great explanation. And that's the concern that, again, obviously first came through our HR directors, and then through the process, through the revision process of the PAA the concerns of, well, we have these people, we only have a year's worth of money, we only have 18 months worth of money, you know, what do we do with them if that money runs out, if that grant doesn't get renewed, if there are other kinds of things, and so.
And if they were civil servants, then they could go bump somebody else, you know, that they might not even, so we're just trying to work through it.
Correct, so we're trying to work through it, and there are, it is a spider web of issues once you get into it, as one issue, as easy as it sounds on the surface, it gets, the spider web gets very complex very quickly as you do that. So we will continue to work on that, and I know it's important. As I've said before, and I will say again at this meeting, at some point we will need to get to a point where one of our campuses, through government relations or others, is going to have legislation proposed, because there is no way under our current legislation, our current act, and our current administrative rules, that we can take up this particular topic in the way that we've been, the way we've been discussing it, and having a, again, in essence, a different set of rules for some civil service employees and not for others. It's going to have to come through our act. So at some point that will have to come about. We are not there yet. And again, I know I try not to speak for the HR directors, because they can speak for themselves. They continue to be very interested in this. But they also, even internally, have some, well, why can't we kind of go down this path and this path as well? And so we continue to work with them and expand.
Okay. All right. Gail?
Hey, Pam. You have my written report at tab 14. I won't repeat everything that's there. There's some cases that have come before us. We're moving those along. You had one of those today. There's been no change to Caldwell versus the Merit Board. That is still on general continuance in the Circuit Court of Champaign County. As to the next page, SIUE versus Chad Bateman, it's actually the State of Illinois versus Chad Bateman. That is someone that we have alleged was cheating on or attempted to cheat on an electrician's test. We are, because our role here is to protect the rules and our examinations, we're working with the state's attorney in Madison County, where SIUE is. They are working on a plea deal where the applicant, the test applicant, will pay a fine and testify under oath about exactly what happened, whether other people were involved, and if there were other people involved, who they were, what their roles were. When more happens, we will be back in touch. As to the most recent Stipe versus Mandillo and the Merit Board, the Attorney General's office has, in fact, entered its appearance on behalf of the individual Merit Board members, the Merit Board generally, Jeff and me, and has filed the hearing record, which is our answer in that matter. That hearing record is more than 2,100 pages, carefully presented and prepared by Teresa, the Merit Board Secretary, and Jen.
Any questions? Okay. Meetings.
So if we can, we have a proposed list of meetings, and I know in a couple individual meetings with some of you, there were some concerns already with them. So
the May 21st is the U of I board meeting.
Okay. So
there'll be three of us not here.
Yeah, if you can grab your phones if they're handy or whatever. What we would like to try and do is at least get some tentative dates that we can put out there. Again, obviously we had to cancel our meeting from the 5th of December, and luckily we were able to get it in today. But to do that, so we can try and get them on your calendar.
Is there any way we can avoid Thursdays?
We don't have care necessarily.
Why can't we use a doodle poll? Yeah.
If we have a board meeting.
Yes.
You're going to get 16 different answers here now, and we're not going to be able to come to. I would also like to ask if this board would consider doing our meeting in January, so that we can follow up on our deferral today just as quickly as possible, in light of, I'm sure, the added stress that it is putting on the individual.
Well, we will do, and we can certainly do that if that's the board's wish. Yeah. The one thing we would like to do is, I know there is one other case that is close to being to you as far as the board, and what I don't want to do is, we'll just check the date, is I would not want to say within a week, have that ready, and then
if it's within a week, fine, but right, I don't think we should put it off for a month.
No, I understand, and so and that's a great point, and so we'll just make sure that that's the case. But again, if it's up to the board to try and do something in mid to late January, we certainly can. That's again the choice, obviously, the board. So, okay.
Yeah, Early January, why even late June?
This is.
To look at January.
Trust me.
Yeah. I just think we owe it to do it as quickly as possible.
You can do it now.
Okay, I have just a couple. Does there anybody have any other like new business or anything they want to? So I just have a couple of very administrative things. When we have things that have multicolor, if you could put the legend in the materials, that would greatly help us. Let's always have the first order of business be approving the minutes. That's pretty typical in how we do that. Then there is one thing that's in here that in the disciplinary area, it's, I don't know what page, it says page 104, but it's in the decision and order of the University Civil Service Merit Board, where it says the University Civil Service Merit Board has examined. This is you doing it on our behalf.
That's correct.
Okay, I would like it to say that because we didn't, nobody in this room did anything in here where it says the Merit Board did it. So I would like to be very specific that it was the executive director on behalf of the Merit Board. Okay? Okay? No, that's okay. I'm just saying. Yeah, I was like, I didn't do this, so why does it say it? And then just so, again, we've been scheduling these meetings for 3 hours. We have not needed the 3 hours, but what happened, we always had them for 2 hours, and then we always went over. So know that hopefully we'll do our best, and when we don't have disciplinary ones, they're definitely over much more quickly. So I appreciate that. And then I do think we should have some rules about for public comment. So like at the U of I board, you have to submit your request for public comment. I don't remember exactly how many days out, but it's a definite number of days, and there are no exceptions to that. And then
I've heard the differing things about that, but that may or may not. I mean, we do the same thing, but that.
And we don't do it that way. We don't show up and sign up.
Yeah, I don't think it's very far out, but it certainly has to be at least the number of. Oh, I think it is. I think it's. We have to put the agenda out. Is it 3 days in advance?
No, you guys probably. Than two.
Sorry?
No fewer than two.
So they at least have to have it by then. That's how we do it. So I don't know.
We don't. Okay. They can just show up. I mean, we prefer and we encourage, but they can show up and sign up. Just like
well, maybe we should have that as a discussion item next time so that the board can decide what they would like to do.
Sure. No, absolutely.
Okay.
Can we add to that just make sure that we research what is permissible for us to ask of them in that application process, because we've learned at Northern at least that there's very little that a person seeking to make public comments needs to provide.
Yeah,
and I just want
to put their name.
Yeah, just their name.
I believe ours. We have to have the topic.
I don't think I don't think that can be enforced.
Yeah,
we ask for it.
I think we do ask for it.
They don't have
to. I'm just saying, if we're going to write new rules,
right.
I'm not sure that can be enforced. Yeah.
Okay, with that, we have no more topics, but if the board would allow me to call for a 5-minute executive session, I would greatly appreciate it. I promise only 5 minutes. All we'll do after that is adjourn. So if you would allow that, if someone would have a motion for me,
so
I would
moved.
Appreciate
also,
it.
Can I ask also,
yes?
Point of order, I guess.
Sure.
Just do we need to specify the nature of the reason?
Why you're going to
yes, I thought
sessions.
We did.
It's related to the matter that we discussed earlier, so we can do that, can't we? It's still about an employee matter, and that's, I know you can go into executive session.
No, ma'am.
We can't?
No, ma'am. The only thing you can go into executive session for is specific employment matters related to the employees of the board and deliberation regarding a hearing that was taken under a hearing officer.
Okay, then I'll just say what I'm saying, and because that wasn't what I was just going to say. I want everyone to know that I spent a lot of time on this before we got in this room because I had many of the same questions. Why didn't this person ask this? Why wasn't this asked? Why wasn't this? So I want you to know that I took it very, very seriously, and that I don't advocate ever for one party or the other. Mm-hmm. I try and just look for fairness, and it frustrates me if it's, these are 6 questions that should have been asked and they weren't, but they have repeatedly told me that's not my job. I can't do that. But just as the chair of this board, I want you to know that this was a very difficult day for me and a very difficult process. And I take it very seriously.
Yes.
You'll gather it very well.
Someone's.
Yeah, and we appreciate that. And I think that is the culmination of moving the rule forward so that we can absolutely have that kind of conversation. So if there are elements, and one of the other things that goes along with that is with our HR directors, because I know they have requested to discuss these kind of topics with you in a general sense as well, and I think you can get some good feedback from them and from the employee group as well, that those are the absolute kinds of things. If we wanted the rule, for example, at the beginning of each hearing, here are 5 questions that are just part of the record. Now, sometimes it may not apply. We had a case last time where there was a fight. Well, how many times they're absent is maybe not going to apply in that kind of case, but there may be other cases where they do. So those are the kinds of things that we can, now that we are in this formal public process of JCAR, we can have discussions and we can add, subtract, modify, whatever you all think is important for you to then make those decisions. And again, I know, looking at our couple HR folks on the other side of the room there, I know those are some of the questions they have too, is how can we, you know, obviously they want to win the case, if you will, because they don't think someone should not be, they're not going to bring a discharge if they don't think someone should be discharged. Obviously that would be foolish to think otherwise. So, but what they have a question sometimes is, sometimes we're not sure, in essence, what you want is, you know, we could at times charge someone with 10 different charges. And then, but is that, you know, is that overkill? Because if you talk about, you know, not calling in, well, there could be lots of other things that flow from not calling in.
No, we don't need to, it's just, I want to make sure everybody knows that I know how significantly this impacts a person's life. I know I really know what our job is now. And I usually don't, you know, I've just seen some things not go very well in a situation like this. And so I just wanted to make sure that didn't happen today. So I appreciate, I mean, I know that it wasn't my decision, it was a joint decision. And so I just appreciate the time we took.
Thank you for your contribution.
So thank you. Thank you.
I would like to say thank you to all of y'all for allowing me to participate by phone today.
Great. Thank you for hanging in there. Okay, do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Happy holidays. I hear a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Meeting is adjourned.